Then I remember looking down beside the bed and seeing green surgical booties walking next to me as I was wheeled to surgery. Then there was a man in a green mask who gave me two shots in the rear. "Ayo, that a TMLL relax you, eh," he said. Then there was blackness. 14, I died, I saw blackness but heard voices. "Ayo, don't you TMT have a good feeling about this one. Ayo, hear you. He has an infection. Here TMS week. His heart was damaged by lightning. He is now TMT in very good physical shape. He taught TMS a challenge. Ayo, yeah, TMLL bet you $10 he does na TMT make it. Ayo, word moron. I rolled over out of the blackness to face the stark brightness of the operating room. I saw the two surgeons and the surgical assistants who were betting on my survival. They were looking at my chest x-rays in a lighted box and waiting for the prep work to be done on me so they could see who would collect on the bet. I looked down on myself from a place that seemed to be well above the ceiling. I watched as they held my arm out straight and strapped it to a stainless steel brace. A nurse painted me with a brown antiseptic and then draped me with a clean sheet. Someone else gave me a shot directly into the foretube. Then a man with a scalpel made a clean, straight cut the length of my breastbone. He peeled back the skin. An assistant handed him a device that looked like a small saw, and he hooked it under my breastbone. Then he turned it on and sawed my chest open. A spreader was inserted into the cut and my rib cage was pried open. The envelope of skin that surrounded my heart was cut away by another doctor. At that point I was treated to a first-hand view of my own beating heart. I don't yet TMT remember seeing any more. I rolled back away from the surgery and into a position that left me engulfed in blackness. I could hear chimes ringing, three sets of three with a tone at the end of each of them. In the darkness tunnel opened. The walls of this tunnel were grooved like furrows in a freshly plowed field. These furrows ran the length of the tunnel toward the bright light at the end. They were silver-gray, speckled with gold. After seeing the opening of my own chest and hearing the doctors place bets on my survival, I knew there was no way I was going to live. Yet instead of being frightened, I was relieved. My body had been a burden to me since it had been struck by lightning. Now it was gone. I was free to roam the universe once again. At the end of the tunnel I was met by the being of light, the same one that greeted me the first time. People often ask if these beings have faces. Neither time did I see a face, just a brilliantly glowing spirit that was firmly in charge of me and knew where I was supposed to go. 161. He drew me toward him, and as he did he spread out, almost like an angel spreading its wings. I was engulfed by these wings of light, and as I was, I began to see my life all over again. The first 25 years passed as they had in my first near-death experience. I saw many of the same things, the years of being a bad child, my growing up and becoming a badass soldier. Watching these early years again was painful, I won't TMT deny that, but the agony was tempered by viewing the years since the first experience. I had a feeling of pride about these years. The first 25 years were bad, but the next 14 were of a changed man. I saw the good that I had accomplished with my life. One after the other, events both great and small were reviewed as I stood in this cocoon of light. I watched myself volunteering in nursing homes, performing even the smallest duties, like helping someone stand up or comb her hair. Several times I watched as I did jobs no one else wanted to do, like clipping toenails and changing diapers. One time, for instance, I helped care for an elderly woman. She had lain in bed so long that she was stiff and could hardly move. I scooped her out of the bed like a child as she could not TMT have weighed more than 80 pounds and held her while the nurses changed the sheets. To give her a change of scenery, I walked around the building with her in my arms. I knew this meant a lot to her at the time because she thanked me profusely and cried when I left. Now, as I relived the event, the perspective I had in this heavenly place let me feel her gratitude at having someone hold her again. I relived a time in New York when I invited a group of bag ladies to a Chinese restaurant for dinner. I saw these women in an alley scrounging through garbage cans and felt compassion for their situation. Escorting them into a small restaurant, I treated them to a hot meal. When I saw this event again, I could feel them as trust of me as a stranger. Who was this man and what did he want? They were unaccustomed to someone trying to do a good deed. Still, when the food came, they were grateful to be treated with humanity. We stayed in the restaurant for almost 4 hours and drank several large bottles of Chinese beer. The meal cost me more than $100, but the price was nothing compared to the joy of reliving it. I saw painting and collage contests that I had helped organize for mental patients at a hospital where I volunteered my time. Because my girlfriend worked as a psychiatric social worker at the same hospital, I had a chance to participate in an experiment that came back to me in this life review. It was a simple one, really. We wanted to take several mental patients to church. Most of these patients were from the Deep South and had been raised singing church hymns. Why not bring them to church, we reasoned, to see if the hymns could tap a sane place in their minds. 163. We took about 20 patients to a large Presbyterian church and had them sit in the back row. By the end of the service, many of the patients were singing hymns that they had sung in the years before mental illness took control of their lives. Some of these were people who had not even spoken in 10 years. While reliving this experience, I felt how going to church had helped ground these mental patients in the real world. I felt the good feelings they had experienced as they drank punch, ate cookies, and relived the good old days they had had in church before something went wrong in their minds and they got so weird. I saw people I had cared for who were suffering from AIDS. In scene after scene, I watched as I helped them carry out daily tasks such as getting a haircut or going to the post office. In this review, I felt the importance they placed upon not being condemned by others for the crime of loving somebody. At one point, my review dwelled on a specific incident of the time I helped a young man deliver the very difficult news to his family that he had AIDS. I saw the two of us as we walked into his parents' ATM living room. He had asked that his entire family gather for this announcement, so the room was filled with his parents, his brothers and sisters, and even a couple of aunts. We took a seat in front of them, and he blurted it out immediately, "Hey mom, dad, everybody, I have AIDS." There was shock all around the room as his words sunk in. The mother immediately gasped and began to cry, and the father walked out the front door and stood in the front yard to be alone with his grief. 164. Everyone in the family had known for some time that something was wrong with this man because he looked sick and had recently lost a lot of weight. But no one dreamed he had AIDS. This was an extremely painful confrontation that did not turn out well. The man was rejected by his father, who could not accept his son's homosexuality. The mother, too, had little to do with her son after this announcement. As I relived the event, I could feel the familiar shame and humiliation at what they had just heard. At the time, I was angry with them because they did not react the way I thought they should. But now I could sympathize with them because I could feel how they felt and knew that it was a sincere shock to hear this frightening news. Nothing in their lives had prepared them for something like this. After we left the living room, he was devastated. We had talked about this moment of confession many times. He wanted to come clean with his family and had sincere hopes that they would accept him. The rejection he felt in that room was like a spear through his heart. I felt terrible about the familiar reaction. I, too, thought they would accept their son. Had I made a mistake in encouraging him to tell his family? Should I have told him to keep it secret? Frankly, I felt sick at the time. "Ayo, listen, eh," I told him as he wept during the car ride back to the hospital. "Ayo, we're gonna die. You had to do it to keep yourself honest and pure. You finally got it out and that is honorable." I had doubts about everything I did in connection with 165, this case. I even went back to the minor parents and begged them to be forgiving in their son's final days. Still, I felt guilt, as though I had helped facilitate a disaster. But now, as I relived the event and could feel every near TMS emotions, I knew I had done right. Even though there was agony on the part of everyone involved, in the end he felt that he had revealed that hidden part of himself to his family and could prepare to die in peace. The life review that came with this second near-death experience was wonderful. Unlike my first, which was filled with mayhem, anger, and even death, this one was a pyrotechnic display of good deeds. When people ask me what it is like to relive a good life in the embrace of the beings of light, I tell them it is like a great 4th of July fireworks display, in which your life bursts before you in scenes that are spiced with the emotions and feelings of everyone in them. After the life review was over, the being of light gave me the opportunity to forgive everyone who had ever crossed me. That meant that I was able to shake the hatred that I had built up against many people. I did not want to forgive many of these people because I felt that the things they had done to me were unforgivable. They had hurt me in business and in my personal life and made me feel nothing for them but anger and disdain. But the being of light told me I had to forgive them. If I did not he let me know, I would be stuck at the spiritual level that I now occupied. What else could I do? Next to spiritual advancement, these earthly trespasses seemed trivial. Forgiveness flooded my heart, along with a strong sense of humility. It was only then that we began to move upward. The being of light was vibrating. As we moved upward, that vibration increased, and the sound emanating from the being became louder and higher pitched. We moved up through dense fields of energy that changed color from dark blue to a whitish blue, at which point we stopped. Then the being at TMS pitch lowered and we moved forward. Again, as in the first experience, we flew toward a range of majestic mountains, where we dipped down and landed on a plateau. On this plateau was a massive building that looked like a greenhouse. It was constructed of large panes of glass that were filled with liquid in all the colors of the rainbow. As we passed through the glass, we also passed through all of the colors contained in the liquid. These colors had substance to them and felt like fog off the ocean. They offered a slight resistance as we entered the room. Inside were four rows of flowers, long-stemmed beauties with cup-shaped petals the consistency of silk. They were every color imaginable, and on each of them were drops of amber-colored dew. Among these flowers were spirit beings wearing silver robes. These were not beings of light. I can best describe them as radiant earthlings. They moved up and down the rows of flowers, emitting some kind of power that caused the flowers to become brighter in color as they passed. These colors would leave the petals and, 167, beam through the panes of glass, sending back a rainbow of colors. The effect was like being in a room surrounded by 10,000 prisms. I found this environment to be tremendously relaxing. The colors and surroundings combined with the humming vibration of the being to erase stress. I remember thinking, here I am, either dead or dying, and feeling good about it. The being of light moved close to me. Ayo, this is the feeling you are supposed to create in the centers, Ayo, he said. Ayo, by creating energies and tones in the centers, you can make people feel the way you feel right now. I became aware of the fragrance of the flowers. As I breathed in the scent, I heard a chant resonating throughout the building. Alilaha Om went the chant, Alilaha Om. This chant made me aware of everything around me, and I began to breathe the fragrance deeply and observe everything with such intensity that it was almost as though I were bathing in it. Alilaha Om, Alilaha Om, went the chant, and I became more and more absorbed in my surroundings. As I did, I began to vibrate at a speed equal to everything around me. I became one with everything around me and could experience everything. At the same time, everything was experiencing me. As I delved into this heavenly world, it also delved into me. There was an equality to the experience. Not only was I given a heavenly experience, I was giving one. As I was blending with this place I call the heavenly realm, it was also blending with me with the same amount of respect, courage, hopes, and dreams. I was an equal to all things there. I realized that true love and understanding make us all equals. Heaven is that kind of place. I would gladly have stayed there. I had smelled the heavenly fragrance and had seen myself among the essence of all things. What more could I ask for? I looked at the being of light, who knew without a doubt what I was thinking. Oh no, you are not staying this time, he told me telepathically. You have to go back again. I did not argue. I looked around and took in a view that time will never erase from my mind. The room was crisscrossed with colors that radiated from the liquid-filled panes. In the distance I could see jagged mountains that were every bit as beautiful as the Swiss Alps. The chant that resonated through the room was as beautiful as a symphony. I closed my eyes and bathed my ears in the sound. The fragrance was wonderfully overpowering. I took a deep breath. And I was back in my body. I passed through no transition zone this time, and the change was very abrupt. It was like being in Buckingham Palace, blinking, and suddenly finding yourself in a garage. I looked around the room and saw other people covered with powder blue sheets. The room was very bright, and everyone in it had tubes in his body that were attached to bags or machines. I could tell there were tubes down my throat and needles stuck in my arms, and I felt as if there were lead in my head and an elephant sitting on my chest. On top of all this, I was freezing cold. Good God, I thought, I feel worse than before the surgery. Where am I? I asked a nurse. Whitmer in the recovery room, she said. I closed my eyes and did not remember anything for another 18 hours. Something happened in the recovery room that I don't remember at all. Franklin told me this story and the doctor confirmed it. Shortly after surgery was completed, one of the surgeons noticed that I was oozing blood from around one of the tubes. He kept an eye on it for some time and then called another doctor in. They decided that they would have to go back in and try to stanch the bleeding surgically. Franklin was standing there listening. When she heard that they were considering another surgery, she pushed by them and kneeled down next to my head. Danyan, the doctor says you are bleeding and they are going to have to cut you open again and stop it. You can stop the bleeding, Danyan, I know you can. Try to stop the bleeding. The doctors stood there for a while and watched. Within a few minutes, the bleeding stopped. And then, said Franklin, they just looked at each other and walked out of the room. Within a few days I had recovered enough to sneak out of bed and take a shower. A few days after that, I, 170, was able to put on street clothes and sneak down to the hospital cafeteria for a good meal. As I sat there eating fried chicken, the surgical assistant who had bet that I would die came in and sat at a table next to me. I introduced myself and then told him what I had seen and heard as they prepared to cut into my heart. He was unnerved by what I told him and even went so far as to apologize for making such a bet when I was still awake. That a TMS quite all right, I said to him. In a way I wish you had won the bet. A15. To be continued, my heart surgery did not make me physically whole again. I was released from the hospital in a few weeks, but in many ways it was like going from the frying pan into the fire. Sometimes I still pass out when I exert myself even slightly. I have often turned blue and been forced to lie down in the middle of restaurants or department stores because my heart wasn't pumping as it should. For a long time I could count on blacking out at least twice a week. I finally learned how to recognize the danger signs and sit down before falling. That saved me several bloody noses. But I still black out about once a month. Some of my medications make me extremely susceptible to infections, and the high dosage of blood thinner I am on makes an ordinary cut bleed like a mountain stream. In the summer of 1993, I cut my finger and contracted a staph infection that kept me bedridden for almost a month. Despite being given massive doses of antibiotics intravenously, I almost went into septic shock. For days, 172, I wanted to die, not so much to visit the heavenly place again, but because I was in such physical pain that I could hardly stand it. Through all of these physical trials, the visions have sustained me. Although I no longer re-attended the celestial classes where the beings of light taught me about building the centers, I have remembered my lessons well and plan to have the first one built very shortly. In 1991 I completed the bed, which is the most important component of these stress reduction centers. I erected it at Dr. Raymond Moody at TMS Clinic in rural Alabama. He was just beginning to study facilitated apparitions, a method by which bereaved people can have visionary encounters with departed loved ones. To achieve the state necessary for these encounters, the patient has to be extremely relaxed. After trying the bed himself, Moody decided that it was an excellent way for his patients to relax quickly. We used the bed with many people, and the results often went far beyond relaxation. Patient after patient reported experiencing intriguing forms of altered states. Some saw kaleidoscopic visions of color, others felt so relaxed that, as one person put it, "AO felt like I imploded." The most common altered state reported was an out-of-body experience. Now that I have been able to test the bed in a clinical setting, I can concentrate on establishing the centers. I am working on the first of these in South Carolina. The focus of this first center will be to help the terminally ill face death. 70 cents of every dollar spent in health care in this country is spent in the last 6 months of a patient at TMS life to extend life an average of 14 days. Those are the most horrendous days of a dying persona, TMS life, and are certainly among the most difficult for his or her family. I think it is TMS important for people to avoid a painful death. I am not advocating suicide, just common sense. Unnecessary life support builds false hopes and prevents people from making a smooth and spiritual transition. It is also devastating for their families, who can pour all of their financial and spiritual resources into keeping a loved one alive just a few days longer. Having died twice, I know that the world that awaits us when we leave here has a lot to offer a terminally ill person. That is why this first center will be a hospice, one that helps the dying person make the transition while helping his family cope with the pending loss. The center will be a place of laughter and deep relaxation, a place where people can heal their spirits and build a strong faith in God. Many people have asked me why I am so relentless about these centers. AO listen, AI say. AO 13 beings of light told me to build these centers. They put it on me. They didn't TMT ask if I wanted to build them, they just told me that that is what I had to do. When I pass, I will be with them forever. Knowing that, I am determined to pull it off. In the last few years, I have spoken to millions of people around the world about my two near-death experiences. At the invitation of Boris Yeltsin, I appeared on Russian television with Dr. Moody and spoke to millions of people in that country alone about my experiences and visions. I was even able to talk about my belief in spiritual capitalism, that all people should be free to worship the way they choose. There are many paths to righteousness, I said, and that is good news for all of us, since no one seems to be on the same path, as far as I can tell. I know that the path I am on is a unique one. I am frequently told this by the people I meet. Once, after speaking to a church group about my life, a woman approached me with a look of puzzlement on her face. She had heard many people speak about God, she said, but never one quite like me. AOE at EMLL bet you drink, eh, she said. AO yes, mouth ma'am, I do. AO and you obviously like women, don't you TMTU? AO yes, mouth ma'am, I do. AO then I will say this, Mr. Brinkley, eh, she said, giving me the evil eye. AO when God was looking for prophets, he must have been scraping the bottom of the barrel to have found you. I couldn't TMT agree more. I only have to look into a mirror and see the man I have become to be totally baffled by all that has happened. Why me? I often ask. Why did this kind of thing happen to me? I never asked for it to happen. I never got on my knees and asked the good Lord to change my life. Why me? To that question I have no answer. Still, in my search for consolation, I frequently find myself reading 1 Corinthians, especially chapter 14, which contains some of the most powerful writing in the Holy Bible. In that chapter can be found two verses that give me comfort, for he that speaketh in an unknown tongue speaketh not unto men, but unto God, for no man understandeth him, howbeit in the Spirit he speaketh mysteries. But he that prophesieth speaketh unto men to edification, and exhortation and comfort. I don't yet know why I was chosen to do what I do. I only know that my work is to be continued. About his other book, At Peace in the Light, is the 1995 sequel to Daniel Brinkley's best-selling book Saved by the Light, focusing heavily on his profound transformation after his second near-death experience, NDE, during open-heart surgery in 1989. While his first book introduced his initial lightning strike and visions, this second book serves as a spiritual and practical guide. It bridges the gap between what Brinkley learned in the afterlife and how he chose to live his life on Earth as a result. Take core themes and content. The second NDE, Brinkley details his 1989 emergency open-heart surgery, during which he clinically died for a second time. He describes returning to the spiritual realm and receiving a specific directive from the beings of light to help humanity overcome the fear of death. At a life review explained, he expands on the concept of the panoramic life review. He emphasizes that in the afterlife, you do not just watch your actions, you actually feel the exact emotional impact of both good and bad that your actions had on others. A spiritual lessons for Earth. The book shifts from mystical experiences to practical spirituality. Brinkley teaches that every individual is a powerful spiritual being, that love is the only true currency, and that our primary purpose on Earth is to make a positive difference through small, everyday acts of kindness. At the birth of his mission, a major portion of the book documents how these spiritual lessons directly inspired his real-world work. It chronicles his transition into becoming a dedicated hospice volunteer, which eventually led to his co-founding of the Twilight Brigade to comfort dying military veterans. A key takeaways. The book concludes with a powerful, comforting message: death is not something to be feared, but is simply a peaceful transition into another room. Brinkley argues that by losing our fear of death, we can finally begin to live our lives with true purpose, compassion, and joy.